I'm Larkin Kemp.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast once again. Our third wheel has hit a flat tire, sprung a flat tire. I don't know what the best expression for that is. I am Terry Foy. He is Larkin Kemp. And this time, Nick Osello is no-showing after a Fighting Irish win. But good for all of you. You're going to continue to get your overdose of blue and gold, because I was actually in South Bend for Notre Dame's win over Virginia and got a lot of color to share with the folks. But in the meantime, I woke up at 5 in order to get back here to press record so that Coach Kemp can practice his sideline crouch, and I am going to get an epic Masters Sunday nap in as a result. Larkin, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing really well. It's senior day here on the farm, Kagan Stadium. We got Denver in the house, and on a human level, I'm personally devastated, obviously, to not watch every swing of the back nine, but focused on Denver, and it was a great slate yesterday. Excited to talk about the games.
Are you going to record and watch it as if it were live, or are you going to catch live? Because your game's going to be over before the Masters is.
Yeah, I think I'm in too many golf-related group chats, and based on the relationship my dad has with his brothers, like, I will be getting real-time text updates, so it's just impossible not to kind of be across it. But this is just one of those rare sporting moments. Like, you know, every decade there's kind of a where were you, and ultimately the game of golf has fallen in love over time with this Rory, you know, 10-year drought and the heartbreak, missed putts, St. Andrews gets caught by Smith, Bryson catches him in Pinehurst. I think that, you know, most people waking up today in Georgia, you know, want the Northern Irishman to get it done. So we'll see what happens. And Bryson's going to birdie every par five. Like, he's not going to make it easy. And this is why you fall in love with sport. It's awesome.
You have really injected the term slate into this podcast. And I think that as I reflect on yesterday, which for our listeners, because this comes out on Monday, is Saturday, I really do think it was the best slate of the season so far. And that probably isn't a controversial take when you've got a crescendo like Army-Navy joining forces with Syracuse-Cornell. Kind of doesn't matter what the rest of the schedule looks like, but it's certainly delivered. And not only that, but for folks who in February were asking for games to be staggered over the course of the day, this was one where kind of, you know, you got a couple of good ones at the noon and 1 o'clock window, but you really had to hang around until 4 or 5 Eastern in order to get your actual fill. We are recording this as Rutgers is up 2-0 on Michigan with 7 minutes to go in the first quarter. Nick's arrival on the podcast last week unannounced and unscheduled really threw our rundown out the window. So we didn't get to the Scarlet Knights win over Maryland in the way that we otherwise would have. And as a result, I think we should say something nice about Rutgers right now. I'll start by, I had this whole thing planned about Carden Stoller because, you know, he's from Baltimore. Just, you know, have had my eyes on his game for a long time. And so because he was so instrumental in that win, you know, I went back and watched all of his saves. And the thing that came away, and I'm curious, you know, you and I have talked about how you analyze goalies, what your thought is on this. I don't think I have ever seen a goalie play a lower crease than Carden Stoller. This dude plays with his heels on the goal line like 85% of the time. And it's insane in the way that it allows him to... I mean, it's one of those things. It's a trade-off, right? Like, are you cutting down angle and the amount of gold that is visible? Or are you trying to give yourself that extra, what is it, you know, 2, 3, 4 one-hundredths of a second to react? And it's just a very interesting style. So that's my nice thing to say about Rutgers. Carden Stoller, very interesting player and obviously instrumental to their success.
Yeah, they've had a kind of fascinating journey through the year. I think most of the public perception was frankly written off when they lost hosting Stony Brook, you know, whatever it was, the 8th of February. But since then, they've kind of been on this steady climb of quality ball. And, you know, not all films made equal, but ultimately like a 70% save percentage against Maryland, who I think is universally thought of as they make great both, you know, shot decisions and they have great placement. I mean, that is like scout, you know, eye turning with respect to... No different than if you're like a left guard and you go to Alabama and you can move the trench. Like, it's kind of a similar idea. So it'll be kind of fascinating to see as they heat up into the Big Ten tournament, can they keep this run going and play spoiler down the stretch? So credit to those guys.
I think this is always going to be a really interesting year for Rutgers and really the group of programs that kind of shifted their identity in conjunction with the creation of the transfer portal. And, you know, I'm not going to pretend like there aren't folks that listen to this podcast that find that to be pejorative and don't give those programs credit, the Jacksonville's and Ohio State's of the world, by virtue of whether it's the choice or the ability to make the choice, right? When there are a lot of programs like the Service Academies and the Ivy League and some of the Patriot League programs that can't. And obviously, it was instrumental in Rutgers' run to the Final Four. Who knows whether or not they would have been able to had they not been able to bring in a pair of Kirsts who were able to get them over the hump. But as the volume of transfers, grad transfers specifically, has decreased, the thing that kind of got lost in the wash a little bit is they had done a really nice job of developing a national recruiting platform, like the ability to find guys in Portland and in Texas and in Michigan that other folks hadn't. And it's funny because they're the state school of New Jersey, and New Jersey, you know, contends with Connecticut and Massachusetts for, and the state of New York for the best public high school lacrosse. And, you know, certainly with Seton Hall Prep and Del Barton and Don Bosco, there's, you know, tremendous, and St. Augustine, there's tremendous private school lacrosse as well. And I think, you know, this is one of the, you know, kind of curses of a lot of these state schools is kids that are really good don't want to stay in state. They want to explore. They want to go typically south. And so as a result, that's not necessarily the advantage that some, you know, might think, especially when you overlay it with, while it is an incredibly historic program, you know, it hasn't had the track record of success such that you're getting sons coming back and contributing, you know, and that's why the Kirsts and the Cardillas are so important, you know, because they are those legacies. And I'm sure that there are more to come, but it'll be interesting to see how the staff readjusts. And I think that that was one of the things that Brian Brecht said after the Maryland win that stuck with me, is that we knew that this was going to be an accelerated growth curve year because of how young we are and because of how limited the familiarity was, even with the guys who transferred in that had experience elsewhere, right? Like, you know, maybe they had 2 years under their belt, but they still didn't have 2 years at Rutgers. And so I think that's kind of what we're seeing. And I think that that, you know, Stony Brook loss was an example of the downside of that early, you know, and now we'll see, to your point, how it shapes up as we get into the heart of the Big Ten. But speaking of the postseason, Larkin, this year we have partnered with the NCAA. The men's and women's championship weekends are heading back to Gillette Stadium, held jointly for the first time since 2017. From May 23rd to 26th, there's nowhere else in the lacrosse world to be than Foxborough, Massachusetts, for 8 of the best and most impactful games of the season. Action starts Friday. It ends Monday. You know you're going to be there. So, for our loyal listeners, you can head to ncaa.com/laxtickets for $5 off all single-day ticket options by using code ILPOD at checkout. Once again, ncaa.com/laxtickets. Enter ILPOD at checkout and get $5 off. Show the NCAA how awesome our listeners are by doing it. I actually had somebody correct the URL in not this podcast, but a different podcast we posted last week, which means that somebody's actually clicking on it and going and buying their tickets. So that's awesome, and we want more of you to do it, especially now that we're 6 weeks out. So let's dive in. There are a lot of places that we could start, as we established at the top, but we are going to head to Long Island for Cornell's 17-12 win over Syracuse, the number one team in the country. Claims the title for Kings of Central New York. Surprise, surprise, CJ Kirst leads the way with 5 goals. You know, this was a game that Cornell jumped out to an 8-2 lead, and then Syracuse was able to claw their way back, get it to 9-7 early in the third quarter. Once again, Cornell responded with a run. Syracuse responded with a run, and then ultimately it was the Big Red who scored 4 of the 5 goals in the fourth quarter in order to put this one to bed after, for I believe the third time, the Orange had cut it to 2. And so, you know, I think it's one of those games where I don't want to say the outcome was never in doubt, but because I do think that, you know, there were points at which it got tense. But at the same time, Cornell exerted their, you know, force. When I was talking about this game throughout the week and in the press box in Notre Dame before the game got started, I felt like, You know, the Orange were kind of poised for a loss. I think that they got what they needed out of that win over Notre Dame. And that win streak had stacked up, you know, pretty substantially. And it's not to say that Cornell wasn't necessarily in a similar position. But at the same time, you know, for me, and again, we all have our lens that we look at these things through. And so it's either confirmation or contradiction. And the point that I've made when we talked about Cornell the last couple of weeks is that their defense is playing better. And that's the question mark. They're going to win faceoffs and they're going to score goals. So the question is, how many stops are they going to get? I don't think that holding Syracuse to 12 is going to be a film that Jordan Stevens is going to, you know, put on a future resume. But at the same time, when you're getting to 17, you're winning comfortably. And so I think, you know, for a rivalry game that was in unique circumstances, played in adverse weather, it is certainly another feather in the cap. And I'm curious from your standpoint, you know, because I think to the extent that, you know, no team's journey is linear and your analysis of the Big Red has been a little bit roller coastery, how much does this win reaffirm any confidence that this is not just a Final Four contender, but a bona fide title contender, which I think right now is kind of the threshold that we're evaluating?
It's a lot. So a few comments. First, on the Cornell side, I think what we're, you know, incremental to everything you laid out, which I completely agree with, I think you're also seeing the power of some, let's call it, below average film. I think they had their B-minus game last week, and I think that Connor and Jordan had their full attention Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday as they prepped for Cuse. I think they doubled down on challenging everyone outside of 15 in that locker room, basically to say, listen, you know, we need our complementary pieces, whether it be a Goldstein, you know, 3-5 yesterday, right? Michael Long, 1-2, Firth, more efficient, Kelleher downhill, generating leverage. You know, they probably, you know, had individual meetings with those guys and really challenged them that, hey, we need to get the, you know, the defense moving and we need to set 15 up for success. And then on the other side of the ball, the piece that caught my eye was Spallina 1-0 with only 3 shots, right? So really what I want to dig into kind of on a post-mortem level is what was their plan there, both on like an individual matchup level and what were they doing behind the ball? And do we think that that can be replicated over a Memorial Day weekend where, you know, perhaps my judgment of Dooley and others, their polls last week was too harsh? The other thing that I think this is important is as league play started about a month ago, you know, we as analysts kind of, you become embedded in, hey, you know, I'm watching the Ivy slate and I'm kind of watching the ACC slate and you don't have much cross comparisons of where these teams stack and how their journeys are trending. So I think what this also does perhaps is give a little bit more fortification, let's call it, to the bottom of the table quality in the Ivy to say that, hey, in a vacuum, Cuse's result in the Dome against Notre Dame was elite, right? But ultimately, even if Cornell is kind of just doing their job, they are the number one team in the country, right? They are a team that, you know, deserves not only to host a game, but to have a fairly straightforward path, and they should be a quality piece of this year's Final Four. But of course, there will be teams lurking in that quarterfinal slot, but it's a huge win. It's a huge win. And on the other side of the fence, the one thing I would just question, let's call it, from Gary Gates' group, and I'm sure, you know, the Cuse faithful feel this way, is this a different team outside of the Dome? And the reality of, you know, maybe they host in the first round, who knows, but in that quarterfinal game, are we getting the team that we saw yesterday or that we saw at Maryland, which I think is a good, not great team? Or are we getting the team at home that just seems to have some juice from those 10,000 strong and seem to have a little bit more pop for whatever reason in terms of downhill leverage and just generating slides? Like, that offense at home is just a different beast. There's something about it. There's an aura to the Dome, as we all know. So, listen, it's a great game. My understanding is there was party buses leaving from every borough in Manhattan, and that there was a ton of alcohol consumed from generations of alums on both sides. So I'm sure it was a ton of fun, and it's a good thing that they do, bringing it down there for recruits and their families, and I'm sure the boys loved it.
All right, I'm going to table of contents this thing because you threw a lot that I want to react to. So first, I'm going to go how Cornell defended Joey. Second, I'm going to go why CJ was such a tough matchup for Syracuse defensively. Third, I'm going to go Cuse outside of the Dome. Fourth, I'm going to go the non-conference element of this, and then I want to get your thoughts on Corgan Sports and the reaction to the stream. So from what I was able to gather while I was second screening this, you know, during the game that was my primary focus, it seemed like Jason Singer was on Spallina. And I think that the reaction, this was a consensus opinion that was relatively easy to see. And so, you know, I think this is not my point. I'm not trying to steal anybody else's point. The reason Joey was so successful against Sean Light and, you know, 4 goals and an assist was because of the way in which he was able to utilize his savvy off ball to get the defense caught in the wash, to generate space, and whether that allowed him to shoot with his feet set or attack off the dodge, and typically off of a switch or a miscommunicated non-switch, then those were the areas where he was finding success. It would be reasonable if, because, you know, and this is in no way meant to discredit Jason Singer, but he, and I would say that this is true for Brennan Staub and Dooley, as Matt Dooley as well, and also their polls. Like, I don't think that Cornell has a defensive personnel, with the exception potentially, and I don't even know how he is post the litany of injuries he suffered, Chris Davis, where you think your success is going to be determined by your physical prowess on your matchup and on the ball. Like this is a group that outthinks, and when they find success, they're outthinking their opponent. So again, out of the corner of my eye, it did seem like the amount of space that they were eating off ball was probably game planned for because of what Syracuse had done the week prior, and also a function of what Cornell defensively is good at. And I think that's a nice segue into, so what's kind of interesting about Syracuse's defense, and it's interesting because it's contradictory, I think, a little bit at least, to their reputation as recruits. Riley Figueres was kind of seen as like an elite number two because of what how good he was in terms of his off-ball, playmaking, all that sort of stuff. I think Billy Dwan was kind of seen a little bit more as a cover guy, and not to the extent that he was like totally a cover guy. Who they are now is like Billy Dwan is like one of the best number two or number three space eaters, hedgers, playmakers, you know, stick handlers in the sport, and that's why he's an All-American. Riley Figueres is a really, really good number one cover guy. But CJ Curtis is 6'2", 215 pounds. Riley Figueres is not that big. And so Syracuse just doesn't have a guy that's going to win that matchup physically. And that was one of the reasons that there were strong expectations that CJ was going to have a day. Now, how frequently does CJ not have a day? We talked about it last week, right? Like, not very frequently. And so, you know, you kind of take that with a little bit of a grain of salt. The Syracuse juice from the 10,000, big deal. Also, you didn't mention it, so I just want to briefly mention it. The team apparently doesn't know how to play when it's not 70 degrees. So, like, that's a factor. Now, it becomes less of a factor as April turns into May. But, you know, just something to think about. I think I heard over the weekend that their first outdoor practice of the season was the day before Maryland. And Maryland was obviously practicing outdoors for 6 weeks at that point. Just a factor. Just something to file away. To the point about conferences and conference play, one of the things that's really interesting, and I'm curious as to how you remember the attitude that you guys had toward Providence and Bryant relative to the Ivy League opponents, right? So basically your non-conference rivals. Because you play those teams every year. So in some respects, like, the familiarity should be just as high as it is with your conference opponents, but maybe it actually isn't, because when you add the conference tournament, you're doubling your familiarity, right? Like, for the two teams, if you make it to the championship game that you're playing with. So the point is that when you go from playing conference opponents, which Cornell largely has, and, you know, Syracuse has obviously played a couple of conference games as well, to then shifting back to a non-conference game where that additional familiarity, and maybe to an extent the additional stakes, right? Certainly, like, ACC elitism, you can imagine that as well. Even though it's a rival, like, yeah, I mean, whatever, it's Cornell. Like, you know, it's not Duke, it's not Carolina, right? So I would imagine that, you know, there's probably something to that. And then obviously, like, you know, a lot of criticism of the combination of the price for the stream, which was $18 from Corgan Sports, and then the quality. And I think that, you know, I don't want to be an apologist for an advertiser. And you know, we've been partners with Corgan Sports since before I started in South Lacrosse, and there's a lot of deep shared history there. Executing these neutral site events is difficult, right? But you're kind of a caretaker, especially for a matchup like this. And you hope for a matchup like this when you plan this, you know, a year in advance, where it's number one versus number four. You already know that Syracuse Cornell on Long Island is going to be a big game and a well-attended game, especially on the basis of how well last year's Notre Dame Cornell game went. And so you hope for this, but then at the same time, once it delivers, then all of a sudden, like, your net drops, right? Like, you know, if this is number 15 Cornell versus unranked Syracuse, nobody's going to care, or you're not going to hear as much about the price or the quality of the stream in terms of execution as you do when it's number one versus number four. And so, you know, I think that you have been in the live event space over the course of your career, as have I, and I'm sure that you've had, you know, successes and failures, right? And, you know, I would imagine the majority of them are internally evaluated. But what do you say about effectively, like, the notion of risk? We talked about this after the monstrous success of taking Notre Dame Maryland to Atlanta. If you're a fan in South Bend or College Park, whichever home game that was supposed to be, you can feel rightfully jilted. But at the same time, if you're not taking Notre Dame Maryland to Atlanta, you're not getting 10,000. And so I guess the point is, or the question is, how do you balance what you need to do in order to achieve the broader goals? And then how do you just evaluate kind of risk and execution success for the folks that are willing to take it, right? And then, you know, willing to shoulder the burden of the criticism, you know, when it falls short of the public's expectations.
Yeah, I just want to double down and agree that I think it's unfair to criticize. We need more commercial models attempting to monetize games like this, right? Like, what Corrigan tried to do is a good thing, not a bad thing. And, you know, we as viewers need to hold ourselves accountable that ultimately, like, streamers, they need to have volume or yield, right? And if there aren't enough people watching, they need to charge a ton. It's really that simple. That's why Flow Sports is like $80 a month or whatever it is, because all they're getting is the grandparents and, like, uncles who subscribe for one game to watch, like, the Big East out of conference, right, in wrestling or field hockey or lacrosse. Like, that is their commercial model, because they don't have the scale to compete with ESPN Plus or, you know, any of the real kind of content aggregators. So I'm not going to criticize the model. What I will say is that live event production is extremely challenging, and I think that as a conference, if I was the Ivy or the ACC, I probably would have put in some, let's call it, guarantees in place around venue selection, because it's just so much easier to roll out the cameras and execute a high-level stream when you're in a building that does it on a weekly basis, right? That is why, you know, you put on a WrestleMania at an NFL stadium or at an arena that does a Taylor Swift concert, you know, three times a week. If there is nuances to kind of fit out and scaling that goes into everything from, like, hanging the lights to selling t-shirts that are just a lot easier to do. So I kind of put it on the schools, but listen, I get why they're doing it. Long Island's it's a recruiting hotbed. You know, half the team is from there. The parents, the grandparents, they want to be able to see the kids play. It makes a ton of sense for raising money from alums, being able to bus out from Manhattan. So listen, on paper, I get the strategy behind it. You know, it's sad, obviously, as a consumer, but we have no one to blame but ourselves. Like, we as a sport need to continue to invest, to advertise, to buy, and to view. And that's really our only path to one day being able to log on to our equivalent of, like, masters.com and watch every single game for free. And it's amazing, right? So you kind of, this weekend, you kind of get both sides of the model, and it's up, you know, for us to determine how we guide our ship a little bit forward. But, I feel bad that the game has been, you know, the distraction of the product, let's call it, because of the nature of the stream.
Yeah. I'm glad I asked. That was an incredible answer. And you also teed me up for an incredible transition into our second game, because you mentioned the ship. And the ship almost sank the tank. You know, I don't know what your expectations were for Army-Navy. There was a 5-goal spread going in. Everybody was asking me my thoughts. I'm like, I know that you throw the records out. This does feel like a year where the talent gap is just too wide. And it wasn't until it was. And I thought Christian Sweezy, you know, he's so good at telling these stories where he's able to find the anecdote that hinges the game. And he talked about how there was a late fourth quarter huddle when Army was down one where Joe Alberici did not need, expect, or necessarily even want, although he certainly didn't say he didn't want, Jackson Eicher and AJ Pilot to vocally step up. But they did. And Jackson Eicher, I believe he scored the game tying goal. But if he didn't, AJ Pilot made the play that set up the game tying goal. It goes to overtime. Will Colletti had violated on the prior faceoff, so Robert Simone was the one to take the overtime faceoff, and that's what set up Jackson Eicher's game-winning take. As a quick inroad to this, and I apologize for putting you on the spot because I got asked this by Kark yesterday. Who, you know, down one, 10 seconds, end line restart. Who's, so CJ Kearse is number one. Whose ball, or whose stick do you want the ball in most? I have my thought. He had his, and I will share it. And then obviously, you know, if Jackson Eicher is your answer, it's not a bad one on this day. But anybody else come to mind?
The one I would add, just because of the youth of their midfield and how standalone him and Petro have to do it, is I think Duffy, with a slightly better complementary cast, would be pretty high-end leverage.
That was Kark's answer as well.
Yeah. I think...
Mine's Sam King.
That's another great one. I wasn't going to compliment Harvard, but I think Kinger's up there. Specifically, I think his decision-making. I don't think he'll turn the ball over, which I think is the compliment I would also pay Eicher in this situation. There's a level of, like, senior comfort and, you know, he's not going to force and jam, and he's also not, you know, the nature in which he probes or goes, it's not, like, goal or turnover. It's kind of, there's a waltz to it. But I like both those answers.
I think the most telling part about that conversation is, I don't think there's anybody from Maryland or Notre Dame that immediately comes to mind. Maybe Jordan Faison if he's playing better than he is right now. But I think that's an important thing to keep in the back of your mind as we start to move from who's going to make the tournament to who's going to win the championship, because sometimes those are the factors that determine. But we don't want to give short shrift to Army Navy. Your thoughts?
I mean, Navy did everything they could. Like, when they went up 11-9 with maybe 5 minutes left and kind of had Army on the ropes, I was just extremely impressed with not only the plan, but also just the execution. Like, they got dominated at the faceoff X. They got dominated on the ground. You know, Army fouled 4 times, but other than that, played a fairly clean game. It's not as if there was some, you know, crazy BU-esque headband and, like, the clear efficiency went down. Like, it was a kind of classic slugfest between two teams that hate each other. This is obviously, it goes without saying, but it's the greatest rivalry in the sport. And more than that, it's how your legacy is defined at these schools. Like, if you're the captain of one of these teams, you know, you're not really remembered for going 12-2 versus 2-10. Like, it quite literally is, did you beat Navy? Which is such a unique relationship to have with a game where, you know, as a coach, you kind of want to say, hey, this is opponent number one. Like, they're all the same. It's just another opportunity to play us. But it's not. I mean, it's Army Navy, and it just means more. I think you nailed it in that it's a representation of, I think, the quality of this, the high end of Army's roster and also their senior class, where, you know, Evan Plunkett, I think, 2 unassisted to tie it, right? And then you go to your kind of horse late, your big righty, and this is a result that, and specifically the way in which it happened, that really helps build the upside case if you want to make the argument that in, say, a quarterfinal matchup with a Notre Dame, like, Army will have enough juice in the tank to be able to go into that strategic timeout game and actually have the ability for Justin Ward to draw something, you know, that can score a goal late on Ryan Wellner and Kevin Corrigan and all the talent on that roster, right? So, you know, I'm not trying to forecast a matchup. I just more mean Army's path will not be easy, you know, based on the nature of their strength of schedule and RPI. Like, I think we all hope they get in. It feels like they deserve to be in, you know, and I candidly want them to run the Patriot League. But if BU clips them, let's call it in the semis, even if they get in as an at-large, right, that's going to be in an incredibly tough first round matchup, probably away from Mikey, right? And if they run the table from here, I still don't think they're above a 6-7-8 seed, right? So Army's path will be tough, but that's what these kids are built for, man. That's what the United States government pours a ton of resources into, and I'm really excited for them. And, you know, pulling for them is the wrong term, but like, I think we all hope they at least put their best foot forward and are in a real slugfest down the stretch.
Army's RPI is up to 6 right now. They've got a top 5 win over North Carolina. So, you know, I think that if you're a Black Knight fan, you want to cheer for the Tar Heels, because that is a really important part of the resume, not just from an at-large bid situation. I would say, you know, it's 6. They're a lock. The highest ranked team in RPI to ever be left out was Duke in 22. They were number 7. But they had 3 non-top 20 losses. Army has 0. That being said, it probably won't stay that high. I will forecast this again. You can check out at Terrence Foy on Twitter. I'll post the projection of the RPI if every favorite, at least, you know, my gut of who the favorite would be, wins from now until the start of the conference tournament. And then as we get close to the conference tournaments, I'll add those games in and we'll play out that math as well. My gut is that Army will at worst slip to 9, which it should be bubble in, but that doesn't include a loss, right? Which is the only way we're talking about this, is if they have a loss and what that loss would mean. Again, we'll forecast and try to lay that out. But yeah, the one thing about this game that we haven't mentioned so far is Dan Daly, 12 saves. Sean Burns 7, and you know Sean Burns' save percentage has been so eye popping. I think it was 2 weeks ago, not last week, but 2 weeks ago. The gap between number 1 and 2, and this was after he had had a bad game, because at midseason he hadn't had a bad game yet, and he was at like 73%, 74%. We're talking Brown 2016 save and win percentage type numbers. So for Navy to get that performance is a big one. And certainly, again, if you're an Army fan looking for consolation, you're not going to have a day like that, again, from Burn. The last thing I want to mention, I want to give a lot of credit to the Navy staff. It is really hard to evaluate coaching staffs when you're an outsider. And that's something that you and I have talked about a few times already this season. And what that means is that if you are an outsider, a lot of times you try to, not that you try to, the things that are most easily evaluated are changes, right? So it's like continuing to do the same thing and having it improve incrementally. That's one of the things about the expression, like, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Like, doing the same thing over and over again is practice. So that's why you expect a different result, because you get better by virtue of practicing. So the point is that as an outsider, when you change things, right, that's when it becomes relatively easy to react to. And this was, Liam Hurley was the most high profile example, but there were some things that Navy did personnel wise that were changes from what they had been doing. And I'm sure some of them were a little driven by, you know, injuries and the like. And we should mention that Zach Hayashi played in this game after not having played since Penn State. So that's, you know, an important source of hope for the midshipmen and their fans going forward in terms of what they can do in the Patriot League the rest of the way. But yeah, just a lot of changes and a lot of tinkering from the Navy staff.
Yeah, just to double down on that. And I think people perhaps are somewhat confused by Kemp's perspective on Amplo and the job he's doing. I genuinely believe that Navy might be the hardest job in our sport. Like, Joe Amplo is a great lacrosse coach. The Navy alumni group have extreme expectations. It is not an easy place to coach, especially when the reality of, you know, 90% of the recruits you talk to, of course, have extreme reverence for the troops and the service and everything that goes into making the decision to become a midshipman. But perhaps, you know, when Harvard offers or Princeton, they take that door instead. So, like, when I wrote the article I did, let's call it a month and a half ago, basically suggesting that the job is bigger than the man and blah, 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 it's more of a tip the cap to the fact that, you know, Rick Soule was, like, you know, 15 games above 500 in the Patriot League or whatever it was, took a team to the quarters and got run out of town because Navy wants to go to the Final Four. Is that fair? Probably not. Like, is Joe doing a good job? Yeah, I think so. So it's more, I was just more trying to give credit to the fact that Navy's a very passionate place and, you know, their alumni deeply, deeply care. So yeah, I thought the staff did a great job yesterday with that plan. And, you know, ultimately, to win at a military academy, you need a little bit of luck with the ball carrier. Like, that is what Alberici has this year with Eichner and Plunkett. So for Joe to go deep, he just needs one of these kids from high school to turn out to be the next great Navy attackman who can gain leverage and kind of help them win those 10-9 games against Hopkins and Army versus lose them. So, you know, I just wanted to double down on that.
That last point is incredibly well said. You know, they've recruited exceptionally well at the defensive end. You know, the kind of factory line that now has AJ Marsh at the you know, crescendo is, you know, that has been well established. They've had a good amount of success with dodging midfielders who, you know, specifically that exceed expectations that the staff had for them coming in. But you're right. It's you know, they've had pretty good complementary wing shooting over the course of the last 7 years. But it's the distributor, right? And I think, you know, one of the things that's kind of it kind of goes back to what I just mentioned with Faison. Like, when, you know, there's this sliding doors notion of what if Xavier Arline decides, especially after he gets replaced as the starting quarterback, that lacrosse becomes his sole focus, right? Like, what does that mean for their ability to have what you just mentioned? So let's keep it moving. Carolina 8, Duke 7. This was a weird one. Again, second screening, but kind of felt like a 50-minute game. Carolina scored to go up 8-6 with, like, Mason Suchak, nice step down with, like, 11 minutes left, and then Duke cut it to 1 with, like, 10 minutes to go. And then the game was just over. Like, I was watching Notre Dame, Virginia, but it was hard for me to kind of take a ton of nuance away from how that unfolded. And, you know, in a game that kind of only features 15 goals and features a ton of stops and was played in sloppy weather, you know, you really do have to be dialed in order to come away with the conclusions of what was going on the field. So, you know, I'm just going to kind of summarize my comments with saying, like, it's remarkable and telling that Carolina had not won in Koskinen Stadium since 2016. There are a lot of things that hadn't happened since 2016 that are happening right now. We're going to get to a couple more of them, which, you know, again, is just kind of funny relative to who the co-host of this podcast is and what that year means for him in terms of his lacrosse journey. But yeah, I mean, you know, to the is Carolina for real, right? That those boxes continue to get checked, and the part of the story that Kevin Brown sunk his teeth into was that they believe. Larkin, what were your thoughts on the Tar Heels getting the Blue Devils?
Yeah, I think it's an important point that you're calling out there, which is perhaps COVID has distracted us from the fact, like, in my own head, anytime I turn on a Carolina game, I'm actually not sure I'm giving enough credit to the lack of success that most of those seniors have had, and the fact that you do have to learn how to win these big road games in the ACC. Like, yes, the result, it kind of looks like a mud fight, right? 8-7 win over a Duke team that I think quite clearly has struggled on the offensive side of the ball, especially with consistency. And, you know, this isn't film that's, like, eye-popping. And, you know, if you compare it to, let's call it Cornell Cuse's result from yesterday, it's hard to get excited about the durability and the fact that a Duffy can take a team to Monday of Memorial Day. But this is a in-state rival. It's one of the biggest games in the sport, and they won in a way that's kind of the antithesis of perhaps how you would think they would, if that makes any sense. Like, you kind of mentally picture more what we saw on Dorrance against UVA, which is, like, Duffy and Petro going off, they're banging pipes, like, young middies emerging, you know, making mistakes on the defensive end, but the 10-man's engaged and getting just enough saves, right? That's kind of my mental model of Carolina. This was a different way to do it. I thought Charlie Johnson, you know, who I have a personal relationship with for Duke, I thought he did a remarkable job, candidly, digging in on Duff and those blow GLE matchups. And So UNC had to do it in a different way, and being forced to win in a way in which, you know, you're uncomfortable, that can be extremely beneficial, because, you know, maybe in the quarters, Ashaun Light and Notre Dame are awaiting, and that is the type of game you're going to have to win. So an interesting result. I think it confirms what we know about Duke, which is very frustrating for their faithful and their families, obviously, but just seemingly can't get their ceiling this year for whatever reason. And, you know, do I necessarily believe in the Tar Heels? I don't know, but big win and credit to those guys.
So a couple things to add. Mike Gianfrancaro, 12 saves. Patrick Jamison, 12 saves. So for a game with 15 goals, to have the goalies combined for 24 saves, that is super significant. Would like to echo your point about Charlie Johnson and the way in which he has taken a step forward as a number one cover defenseman this year. From a Duke tankering, Duke offense type situation, I knew that Liam Curtius got reinserted into the starting lineup. Looking at the box score right now, Andrew McAdory was listed as an attackman. I don't know whether or not he played attack. I'm assuming that he did, because the starting midfield was Jack Papendick, according to the box score, again, Max Sloat and Ben Johnston. I did notice, again, you know, kind of hard not to. Sloat shot 2 for 8. Ben Johnston shot 2 for 8. You know, those two goals are notable. Those, you know, combining for 16 shots when the team itself only takes 36 is also notable, especially when you consider that McAdory and Eric Molliver combined to take just 2 shots. Molliver did not take one. McAdory 0 and 0, Molliver 0 and 1. And so, you know, first of all, obviously, tip of the cap to Carolina's both defensive plan and execution. Kai Prochazka, I think, he's one of my favorite players. You know, coming to, the game that I focused most closely on Carolina was the Hopkins game, and he was one of my takeaways. Parker Hoffman playing the wing was another takeaway. He scored a goal, which, you know, has to be really, really cool for him. But, you know, I think. The world knows that Chase Colucci is kind of the number one and has done a really good job all year. Kolasim and Kai Prochazka have done a great job in the second and third roles. And obviously, you know, they clamped the Duke attack on Saturday. And so, to the point about, are they for real? Again, just to frame what an otherwise open to interpretation term means, you know, my expectation for Carolina this year was the same as my expectation for Syracuse last year. There, with 5% lower, meaning that, like, I was, especially with Jordan Stevens and Sam English, I was like, Syracuse is too talented not to make the tournament, and they were almost certainly going to get a home game, just based on that talent level, which means that the expectation is that you win your home game, right? So that means the expectation is you go to the quarterfinals. Are they good enough to go to the quarterfinals? My answer for Syracuse was, yeah, they're talented enough, but do they know how to win? Because usually all 8 quarterfinal teams are talented enough to be quarterfinalists. What determines whether or not they win is the teams that know how to win, right? And I think, like, Denver Syracuse was a really good example of that last year. I'm not sure that Carolina's talent coming into this season put them in a category of they're almost certainly going to host, and therefore the question is quarterfinals or Final Four. Now, based on their resume, that is the group that they are in, right? Like, they're way more likely than not to host a game, which means that they're likely to win, and then that means the line of success is, did you win a quarterfinal game or not? And for me, the answer is no. Like, this group hasn't won enough to the point where I believe that they know how to win relative to the likes of Maryland, Notre Dame, probably Cornell, and then name a fourth team. Maybe that's the pathway, right? Like, you know, if it's a Carolina Army quarterfinal, like, then which of those teams knows how to win more or better? And that's what's going to determine, you know, this very, very narrow margin. But that's effectively what we're looking at right now, right?
Yeah, I think they have a ton to play for here in these next 2 weeks, because I think if they beat Notre Dame at home, or they go on the road to the Dome and beat Cuse, what that does for the resume and potentially getting a top 4 seed, They are the classic example of, like, the path really matters. I think if, say, they get St. Joe's in the first round and then they play either Army or Harvard in the quarters, I think they could potentially go to the Final Four. If they, you know, end up as, like, the 8 seed because they drop the next two or whatever it is, and have not only a really challenging first round, but then you have, like, a giant waiting in CJ Kirst or whoever in the quarters, to your point, I think they're still on the trajectory curve. But you know, it's been a long time in Chapel Hill. Like, I didn't even know if my own mental model, I gave enough credit to that fact. So good for them.
Maryland 13, Ohio State 8. This game wasn't as close as a 5-goal final score would suggest. The Terps blew it open from the 10-minute mark of the second quarter through the 10-minute mark of the third quarter, turning what was a 4-3 Maryland lead into a 11-3 Maryland lead. And, you know, it was what you would expect. Saves, diversified offensive production, the Bryce Fords and Matthew Keegan's scoring goals, a lot of unassisted goals in this one. And I've used the word workmanlike a lot, and I think this was another workmanlike performance in front of 3,000 fans in Columbus the day of the Ohio State football spring game.
Yeah, it just feels there's. I know Maryland's playing actually a little bit faster this year, but it feels like a tough matchup for Myers in that a lot of what he and his staff do well, like the way in which I frame Ohio State, is somewhat in the shadow of Tillman and Maryland. It's kind of like a college basketball chess match. If not for the shot clock, both these guys played slow, like they wanted to kind of out execute versus out athlete, even though they both recruited a high level, right? They kind of view the game through very similar lenses. And honestly, to their credit, Ohio State has just truly outperformed over the last 5-6 weeks at a level that felt like heading into this matchup, especially with Maryland coming off the 8-6 loss at Rutgers. It just kind of felt like there might be a regression to the mean. And this was a game that, you know, I had forecasted kind of somewhat going the way it did, not necessarily because, you know, I had an Oracle moment, more to this is what Maryland does. Maryland's frustrating in the way in which they seemingly play up in these types of moments, but then somehow get clipped once or twice along the way, which I'm sure is eating at Tills. But two great teams, two teams similar to the Carolina conversation we just had, who, you know, fall in that bucket now with their resumes of it's Final Four or bust for them in that room and that senior leadership group, and, you know, putting their head down over the next month and just, you know, clipping away at body blows and, you know, seeing where that takes them. But I think the other thing I'd say, which you laid out quite well with your question from Kark around primary dodging, is we all know how Cornell will dogpile if they do. It's with 15 in a truly, like, generational performance that ends with him, you know, in D.C. at the Torreton ceremony. With Maryland and Ohio State, the way in which they attack is somewhat nuanced on a week-to-week basis, and it seems like there's, like, different guys kind of having their coming-out moment. So I actually just find them fascinating on film, and it's just going to be kind of interesting as we head into the Big Ten tournament with the way in which some of these teams are trending to see who kind of comes out of there alive. But I'll pause there.
So you talked about the kind of playing above their level component of what the last couple weeks had been for Ohio State, and it just prompted me to take a look at something, and I didn't realize how stark and jarring this is. I'm just going to read a bunch of numbers in order, and you can guess, you're going to figure out pretty quickly what this is. 71, 83, 67, 60, 71, 58, 59, 53, 65, 63, 60, 46. Any ideas?
Well, it's either shooting percentage, offensive efficiency. It's some number that has to do with them, like, outperforming their execution.
It's Caleb Fiach's save percentage. And, you know, talking to a couple of folks that know Ohio State very well as an opponent over the course of the last few days, that was basically the premonition, is that, yeah, they're going to go as far as Fiach is going to take them. And, you know, as soon as he has a not standing on his head type of day, they are going to be a little bit more vulnerable defensively. I use the term defense by goalie a decent amount. I don't think that is what Ohio State is. I think that they are very complimentary in terms of what they do stylistically on and off ball and what they hope and ask for out of their goalie, and their goalie has delivered it until yesterday. That was the first time he was below 50% this season. And it's not just like below 50%. I mean, this was, you know, with the exception of going 53% at Denver, I mean, he was high 50s to 70, you know, the whole time. And so, yeah, it's just it's something to file away. And again,
those without, really are remarkable numbers. I'm looking at them now again.
Yeah.
71-83 is the one that caught me. That's when I moved to shooting efficiency. I mean, does that make him a surefire first-team All-American?
I don't. Yeah, I mean, it's funny
when you
because
consider the quality of those stats and the quality of their schedule, that's pretty wild.
Well, so it's a judgment. It's you know how like
706 against Virginia is crazy.
It's crazy. I don't know how big of an NBA fan you are, but one of the big criticisms of the modern NBA is tell me who made more threes and I'll tell you who won the game. I don't want to make it more simplistic, but at the same time, 70, 59, 63, 57, 62, 84, 68, 45, 56, 47, 56. Logan McKinney's save percentages so far this year. Those two that were below 500, or below 50%, excuse me, Michigan and Rutgers. 45% against Michigan, 47% against Rutgers. I mean, tell me whose goalie played better, and I'll tell you who won the game. And I think that's ultimately why to me right now, the goalie battle, it's kind of funny. Like, and you know, Sean Byrne, obviously, like we've already talked about him a little bit. You know, the three teamers, I think, are unquestionably at this point, McNaney, Fiok, and Byrne. I think that there is an eye of the beholder, not necessarily in terms of what you value stylistically, more in terms of what you value on a, it just sucks to say, but it's true, the multi-year basis, right? Like, does Logan McNaney get the nod as the first teamer because
of
what he's done?
Yeah, yes. You're right. It is unfair, and the nature of All-American voting shouldn't necessarily be that way, and I'm sure there's people who will be frustrated hearing it, but there is a human element to the voting where, you know, there is a body of work component, especially for the Torreton and First Team All-American awards like that. I get that. It's just interesting. For people perhaps who are somewhat confused, like the nature of how stick technology has evolved and how good the athletes are at this level, like goaltending is the fulcrum point of the efficiency of a defense, because the defensive coordinator's job is to determine basically like who will get their hands free and to hopefully do it on the run and with their offhand. But like everyone is getting high quality shots at this level. And like you ultimately need a Caleb Fiok to be on an island, you know, someone's left hand 14 yards downhill, like you need to make that safe, right? It's unscreened. And that's the difference between like losing 12-10 and winning 12-10. And that's what's very unique about lacrosse. In the women's game, it's the 8-meter as an example. Like you got to get saves at the 8-meter. And it really is the difference between championship or bust.
One last thing about Ohio State. So I was having this conversation with Chris Cotter yesterday, where he was just like, that Utah loss is too punishing to their RPI. And, you know, I'm going to dig in a little bit on this because I'm not totally clear. So I mentioned that Army is number 6. Ohio State is number 10. Army's record is 10-1. That comprises 25% of the RPI. Ohio State's is 11-2. That comprises 25% of the RPI. The reason that they're good comparisons is because Ohio State's strength schedule is 50%, or is 19. That represents 50% of the RPI calculation. And then Army's is 21st, which, like, for Army to be that much higher, and then the last 25% of the equation is your opponent's opponent's schedule, which is just so similar, right? It just gets so noisy that it's, like, not... I'm confused. And it's not like I'm quoting the rankings, but I'm also looking at the raw number. Like
I would push back on Cotter. Like, I think what's killing him. So Utah obviously is a drag. It's for a month. They played Mercy, Cleveland State, Bellarmine, and Air Force. And while on paper, they punched him in the face. Like none of those teams helped them in that.
I totally agree, and that was the point that I was going to make, but that is kind of contradictory to the fact that their strength schedule is 19. Now, their strength schedule is 19 because of the quality opponents that they have played since them, so it really is just about, I mean, and maybe that's what it was, because it was like 60, on March 1st. So, like, yeah, I mean, it is kind of the combination of those two things. But it's also not necessarily, it's not, like, the strength schedule is not our perception of how good Detroit, Mercy, Cleveland State, Bellarmine, and Air Force are. It is what those four teams' cumulative record is, right? So it's like, you know, once Bellarmine or Air Force reel off three or four straight wins in the A Sun, now all of a sudden, you know, the drag that they are in the strength of schedule starts to diminish a little bit. And, you know, none of those four teams, you know, Detroit Mercy was 1-6. They're now 3-6. Cleveland State was, let's see. Well, they've only won one of their last four. We're getting into the weeds here a little bit. But my point is that, like, you know, there's something else to why Ohio State's RPI is 10 and not, like, 8 that I'm going to try to wrap my arms around.
Yeah, I mean, Bryant and Denver are probably slightly below. Like, if Myers was forecasting RPI before the season, Bryant typically is, like, 12-3 because they play in an easy conference, right?
Yeah.
And Denver obviously rolls the Big East. So, like, neither of those results are helping them as much as they typically would math-wise. But, yeah, it's the blessing and the curse of what, you know, who you choose to schedule out of conference and the consistency at which those teams year in and year out are in, let's call it, the top 30 of the math. Like, it is a true decision. Like, when you open the way Ohio State did this year with five straight games against teams that realistically will be outside of the top 40 in RPI, there is an extreme beta on that if you drop one of those games, right? Yeah. You, like, have to win all five.
Notre Dame 12, Virginia 7. I went out for this one, and no offense to these two teams, but I went out because Notre Dame put together a high school event, I guess. I don't even know what to describe it. Three games on Friday, two games on Saturday. Supposed to be two games today. Hope that the folks affected by either the virus or the food poisoning on Loyola Academy start to feel better. Their game against Chaminade got canceled. But, yeah, six really, you know, compelling matchups. I would call it four good games, two lopsided outcomes. But an opportunity to get live eyes on a couple teams that I had already seen this year, including Chaminade, but saw St. Anthony's live for the first time, Valor Christian, MICDS out of St. Louis, the aforementioned Ramblers out of Chicago, St. Ignatius out of California, who continued their trip to Fairfield Prep on Tuesday and then Lawrenceville on Thursday as part of their spring break. So a tremendous slate there for the Wildcats. And I think that the most in Upper Arlington from Ohio, I think the most substantial outcome there was that St. Ignatius took Chaminade to the limit in a game that was heavily influenced by Indiana officiating. The Flyers jumped out to a big lead, and then the Wildcats chipped their way back. But just really fun to watch all that high school lacrosse, and it coincided with Notre Dame's football spring game. And then the punctuation mark was a Cavalier trip to Arlotta Stadium that, you know, Larkin, this was the most fun I've had watching lacrosse so far this year. First of all, game started at 5 p.m. local time. They opened the gates at 4. There were 1,500 people in their seats by 4:05. It was unbelievable. I've literally never seen anything like it at a lacrosse game. It was awesome. From there, it was a baseball game. It was 4-4 with 4 minutes to go in the third quarter. McCabe Millen, who I think it was prior to this, left the field after taking a big hit and had some sort of... He came back with his lower leg. I believe it was his right leg taped up. He got switched on to Ben Ramsey, dusted him, got hands-free righty step down. Thomas Riccardelli caught it. Ramsey leaked out, caught an over-the-shoulder pass, led the fast break, head fake to Chris Kavanaugh in the top righty shooting spot, and bouncer. Crowd had been waiting just a long time to erupt. And, you know, talking to Kevin Corrigan post-game, I made the analogy. It was like, you know, for what is typically associated as a savvy football crowd, the way they responded to Ramsey when he started his transition run to the way they exploded when the ball went in the net was akin to when a quarterback throws a 50-yard pass. You see people start to, like, get out of their seats when the ball leaves his hand, and then the eruption when the ball gets caught. So very cool from a savviness of the crowd standpoint, but not to be outdone. So the thing about, you know, there are still questions about Notre Dame's offense that need to be answered. They got held scoreless for 40 minutes against Syracuse just a week ago, and for 40 minutes they got held to four goals by a good but maybe not great Virginia defense. The game plan coming in was to get Chris Kavanaugh in space, similar to what they had done with Pat Kavanaugh when he was guarded by Kenny Brower the last couple of years. It didn't work. At that point, kind of leading up to Ramsey's transition goal, Chris had shot 1 for 8. And again, the Irish offense had been stymied. He decided, I think very much influenced by the juice from the crowd, to put his shoulder into John Schroeder at GLE. And I mean, he got maybe 8 inches of space as a result. And he used it to dunk, literally, from, you know, toes outside the crease. I don't know that a stick had hit the goal, but if it didn't, it probably could have. And he just manages to sneak it in the top right corner past Matt Nunes, you know, lands in the crease but below the goal mouth. And it was funny because the Virginia staff is reviewing it, and Chris is watching them review it. I'm sure he didn't know for sure whether or not he had fallen in the goal mouth. He sees Lars shake his head at Logan Greco or Kip, and at that point, he just gives like another double fist pump because he knew that they weren't going to review it, which meant that it was going to stand as a good goal. And then about – that was like only a minute after the Ramsey goal. And then a minute after that, Jordan Faison sweeps to the middle. Jake Taylor is just an absolute hockey player playing lacrosse. I mean, so he just dives at the ground in order to either get out of the way of the shot or I don't even know. But he just ends up getting hit with the shot. So now the ball's loose in front of him. He scoops it, two hands, and just throws. He's got his back to the goal. He's on his knees, and he just throws it backhand behind him. If you watch SportsCenter, it was the number 7 play, and deservedly so, and just an absolute ridiculous notion. And then Jalen Seymour made it 8-4 with a goal with 10 seconds to go in the third. And that was it. The game was over. They traded 3 goals in the fourth quarter. But, you know, I called it a fait accompli, and it absolutely was. And, I think, generously, it's like dark early in Charlottesville. Realistically, you know, their season probably ended 2 weeks ago. But for the Irish, you know, you get back on the winning train, you're 6-3, you're heading to Carolina, you got a big game coming up ahead, and all in all, just, you know, a celebration of lacrosse. So I'm tired, but that's where I'm getting my energy from. So your thoughts on the Fighting Irish taking care of the Hoos?
I think you did a great job describing both not only the atmosphere there, but more or less how the game played out. There was a 3-minute clip in the fourth quarter that basically just defines Virginia's season. They were in the 10-man. They rode the ball back, I think, 4 different times, and attackers had basically like hands-free dunks. First one, McCabe throws into the guy's knees. The second one, Sunderland misses the net, no backup. I think Ware had a shot, no backup. And you can just see like Lars's brain kind of like melting in real time, because the reason I picked that specific clip is Virginia's super athletic. Like, they make plays in the middle of the field. Like, they can create havoc. They're not devoid of talent, but there's just like a lack of execution that must just be eating that staff alive. Like, this is the classic year where next year they're gonna like come out on the other side of the field, like they're gonna flip the benches, the O is gonna now sit on the other side of the locker room, like they're gonna practice early if they're currently practicing late, like they're gonna fire the team chef, like the whole thing is just gonna get, you know, eaten from the, you know, the inside, because of the nature of, I think, probably how frustrating it is that they really do feel like they're close. You know, it's 4-4 in the third quarter against the defending national champs, coming off a loss in the Dome. Like, they're not that bad, but they just seemingly can't get over the hump. So I feel for those guys and hope they find more success next year. And I know that staff will grind at it. That's who Lars is. So, and for Notre Dame, I think it's confirmatory, I'd call it, of what we know about them. Like, they have great players, they have established experience, but they're also not complete, and they're, you know, unpolished this year. So their path is far more jagged, but they made the plays they needed to down the stretch, and just a great day and a great weekend for lacrosse and at Arlotta, and one of the true, you know, elite venues now in our sport. So happy for that program.
We'll shift into quick hitter mode. The next biggest result, Denver 7, Georgetown 3. if the final score didn't tell you what you need to pay attention to, Dan Kaplan will, because he provided a little bit of a summary of this one for the Inside Lacrosse staff that I'm going to use. Denver defense, super compact at all times, zone with some really funky principles. Even in man, they're super comfortable with just going adjacent and rotating behind it, way more than other teams are willing to do. And, you know, the faceoff matchup was going to be interesting because Ross Prince came back last week and, you know, Michael Krause had been a little bit of an Achilles heel for the Pioneers. That was certainly true in that loss to Yale earlier this season. Malcolm Cleveland, you know, we've talked about it a lot. They've gone back and forth, and Matt Brown has been more committed to Cleveland than perhaps the numbers suggested early in the season, with freshman Grayson Manning playing pretty well, but got paid off in this one. Again, it's hard to divorce goalie play from the defense in front of it. I really sunk my teeth into the Denver defense after that quarterfinal game because, you know, there was just a lot about, you know, the coaching and the personnel. It was really interesting. And the personnel is completely different, and yet the results kind of continue to bear some fruit. So your thoughts on what this win means for a Denver program that's just got alligator blood and a Hoya team that was only able to put up three at home?
I think the three at home was concerning. Listen, Matt Brown is one of the great grinders in our sport. Like, he's a true... Like, he could coach an NHL team in the sense that his mentality is Chief Berube. Like, he's not going to give up on this team, irrelevant to how bad it's looked at times. And they are not a group you want in the first round if they win the Big East with how low their RPI is. Like, that is a classic avoid-at-all-cost matchup in comparison to some of the other teams you could draw. So, you know, I'm not necessarily shocked that, like, Denver beat Georgetown. I think it's just the way it's happened this year where the Big East is just such a mud fight. Like, it 7-3 in a football score... it's concerning.
And 14-2, 14-2 is two touchdowns to a safety, Providence over Marquette. And, you know, Marquette had been playing well.
Right, right. Marquette had been playing well. I think anyone who claims to know what's going to happen at this Big East tournament has no idea. You know, and I think just because of the recent success in the room, I think Denver probably has a senior leadership group that will hold people accountable as the weather turns and as, you know, people start drinking more on campus and as there's a lot of other things to do, frankly. So I'd probably shade there if I had to, like, bet my portfolio on it. But, you know, ultimately it's a B-minus group this year, and we'll see how far they can go.
How's your portfolio doing this week?
It's been an interesting month, to say the least.
I can't be remiss to mention that Villanova beat St. John's 10-7. So it was just – I mean, for a conference that doesn't have any football teams, sans – Georgetown's 1AA squad. It was football all over the place. Biggest upset of the week, Lafayette 11, Boston University 9. I believe the Patriot League top six might be set as Holy Cross lags behind, and then Loyola and Bucknell both are sitting on two wins. Each of them have Army and Navy left to play. So unless one of them pulls an upset and one of the teams stuck on three wins, can't add another one. We know who the teams are in the Patriot League tournament. But shout out to Pat Myers and group, you know, back-to-back wins over the Terriers, first time getting to four wins in the Patriot League. This is just a consummate build. You know, it's been incremental and it's been steady. And I think that's one of the hardest things to do in sports, especially with, you know, a perennial cellar dweller. And so tip of the cap to what that group has done.
Yeah, I think he's a potential front runner for the Osborne this week. People don't understand how bad Lafayette was. I mean, just for perspective, the previous regime, 3-35 in the Patriot League, was Jim Rogalski. Ed Williams went 0-8 in his 1 year as the head coach in 2018. I mean, this is a bad, bad program that he inherited. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for Pat Myers. When I was a player, he was kind of the recruiting coordinator of Penn, and I thought he did a really good job, you know, getting some really high-quality guys, not only well-known, like, inside the cross top 100 types, but also they hit on some, you know, down the table athletes. So I've always respected him, like, on a human level, and I was nervous, is probably the word I'd use, when he took that job, because it's like, okay, like, I don't even know if, like, Bill Tierney could win the Patriot League at Lafayette, right? I mean, it's a hard job. But like you said, consummate build, grinding at it, you know, 4-11, 0-6, 0-11, 4-11, 6-10, 6-7, now 8-4. I mean, just grinding at it, man. And, you know, one athlete away. Maybe someone this summer, you know, looks at this roster. It's a fun place to go to school. You know, big social life down there. It's like, hey, I'll be the attackman that changes Lafayette, right? I'll be the midi, the first ever top 100 recruit or whatever it is. Who knows?
I didn't know. It's fun to go there. I didn't know that.
Yeah. The easiest way to frame it is there's so little to do at those schools, Lafayette, Lehigh, et cetera, that it's like, you know, it's like frat mayhem. They go bananas. It's the classic inverse relationship of what you'd assume.
Yale runs away from Dartmouth in the second half, clinches their 14th straight Ivy League tourney spot. If you know what that means, it means that there has never been an Ivy League tournament without the Bulldogs in it. And it was in jeopardy. Had they lost this game to the Big Green, that probably would have meant that this was the first one. And elsewhere, Princeton and Harvard clinched their spots. And now we just find out whether or not it's going to be in Ithaca, which is everybody's expectation as the Big Red have just one loss. Or wait, they're still undefeated.
They're still undefeated in the league, yep. Yeah. It's going to be a fascinating semifinal matchup. I mean, Yale's trend. Listen, Yale, I'm not a Yale guy. Everyone knows this. I love beating up on them when they were 0-4. Like, at no point did I actually think Yale was a bad group. Like, that's not a team you want at 1-5, 2-5, whatever it is. They do have a deficiency this year. They're bad on the defensive side of the ball. Like, truly. Like, if you clip the highlights of what they did to CJ Curtis and the amount of space they gave him, when you consider that all week they probably talked about like taking away his time and space, clearly there's like some issues on that back end. So what will be interesting as they trend is this is now like an offensive ball club. They need to score 20 goals, I think, to win at Sholkoff in the semifinal. Will they be able to do that? Maybe. I mean, I think that the good news for Connor and Jordan Stevens, obviously, is that you rightfully called out that Yale's RPI has skyrocketed. So it's actually not the drag that I think some people in their mental model may assume based on how Yale was, whatever, 1-5, 2-5. But the other thing I'd call out is Sean Kerwin to me is still the Ivy League coach of the year. Like this game, Paradigm had a dunk on the back pipe to make it 8-8 at half.
Yeah.
In a game that Yale had to win. Like Dartmouth didn't not show up. Like they're not fading in the sense that the product on film still looks okay. And they've gotten a lot better this year. I'm sure people will give it to Jerry, but like he would be my vote for Ivy League Coach of the Year in the sense that I think his roster is still pretty bad, and he got a lot out of the group this year. And I know it probably hurts for those guys because when they went to Franklin and they were 1-0 in the league, I'm sure they had dreams of the Ivy tourney. And it is what it is, but still a huge game with Brown, you know, looming, and there's still things to play for up there, first winning season in a while, etc. So, you know, I guess credit to Andy Shea. They're back in the tournament. Those semifinal games will be fascinating. It'll be fun to watch. It's just a bummer. I prefer when it's at Princeton or somewhere closer so that we can all go. Ithaca's just way out there. But a great home field advantage for the Big Red.
So do Kark and Cotter, because as soon as the championship game is over on Sunday, they got to hightail it to Bristol in order to be on the selection show. Exactly. Last one, Fairfield continues to take care of business in the CAA. This time, 13-10 winners over Delaware. Will Consoli was the star with 4 goals and 3 assists. Sets up an incredibly compelling matchup at Towson next Saturday. The Tigers, while their season-long record of 7-5 might not necessarily pop eyes, they are 5-0 in the CAA. And this one is basically, I mean, you know, maybe instead of, I assume the highest seed hosts. And if the Stags win this one, they're in the driver's seat. So if you're going to be back home, you can check out the CAA tournament if the Ivy heads to the Gorges.
This was an impressive result. You know, this was one I candidly thought Ben DeLuca could pull out. I think the Stags, to their credit, have not faded. Like, they are grinding. It's not going to be easy for them in that tournament, and they obviously need to win it to get in. But, I mean, their RPI is at 14. Like, their quality roster this year, Bax has. And this is also one of those, you know, if you're a 2 or a 3 seed, there are some years as the 2 seed where, you know, Maryland hosts, like, Quinnipiac or something, right? This is not one of those years where you want the CAA champ. Like, Fairfield's a quality roster, and that's not going to be a layup. Like, it's going to be a grind of a game. There's a ton of seniors on that group. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. Good result.
Larkin, recording the Tailgate Podcast and watching you go out and take the lady card to a senior day victory, a tradition unlike any other. Enjoy it, brother.
I will, and everyone enjoy the Masters. Great day for golf.